Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Are you a psychotherapist looking to enhance your practice? The Awareness Integration Therapy developed by Dr. Fujian Zeng is a comprehensive guide to the principles and techniques of this powerful therapeutic approach. Join the growing community who have elevated their practice and expanded their skills by embracing Awareness Integration Therapy and witnessing its life-changing impact. Order your copy on Amazon now.
Do you wish to wake up one day and hit the Life Reset button? Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zeng, helps you navigate crucial life areas, heal the past traumas, and cultivate fulfilling relationships and careers. Life Reset is your guide to a profound journey to reshape your life. Grab your copy on Amazon or Audible now and embark on a path to a more joyous and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Fujian Zeng, psychotherapist and author and the creator of the Awareness Integration Theory. And I'm so thrilled to have you join us today for what promises to be an insightful discussion. In this episode, I chat with Dr. Donald Meichenbaum. He's a psychologist, a distinguished professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Waterloo, Ontario. He's a research director of the Melissa Institute for Violence Prevention and Treatment at the University of Miami. Dr. Meichenbaum is known for his research and publications on psychotherapy and contributed to the development of the technique of cognitive behavioral therapy. He has been voted by the American Psychological Association the 10th most influential psychotherapist of the 20th century. He also is chosen as the most valuable contribution the general field of psychotherapy of that year by the Journal of Contemporary Psychotherapy. Dr. Meichenbaum developed a therapeutic technique of cognitive behavioral modification, published in 1977 Clinical Handbook of Cognitive Behavioral Modification, an integrative approach, which is in an umbrella term describing treatments that aim to change overt behaviors by changing thought patterns and cognitive processes. He has authored 12 books, with his recent one being Treating Individuals with Addictive Disorders, a strength-based workbook for patients and clinicians, which was published in 2020. I've always learned from him every time I've watched him in conferences, every time I've had him on the show. And it's today we're going to actually talk about anger, the manifestation of anger, what the distinction between the emotion and the expression. What it is that you can do looking at your anger and how it's being expressed and the result that's creating in intimate partners, in your life, in so many different levels. He gives us specific interventions in how to monitor, how to shift, and how to look at ourselves. And how to promote shift in our world. And also one of the most important facts that he discussed in this podcast is giving women or giving receivers of the abuse to really look at criteria of how they are choosing their partners and give them really appropriate skills and how to distinguish the vulnerabilities of that person who's coming to you and how that vulnerability could possibly turn into abuse at one point. So there's a lot of jewels in this discussion, and I hope that you learn and enjoy it as much as I do. Now, be sure to subscribe to this podcast on my YouTube channel and connect with me through my website, fujianzeng.com, or any of my social media platforms. So share your thoughts with me. I'd love to hear from you. So without further ado, I'm excited to have Dr. Donald Meichenbaum.
Intentional Parenting, a Practical Guide to Awareness Integration Theory, written by Dr. Jafari, Dr. Fujian Zeng, and Dr. Manoukian, three experts in human development, is your step-by-step guide to raising a healthy child prepared for a culturally integrated world. We're supported in parenting infants to adolescents using the latest evidence-based scientific research on parenting. Order your copy on Amazon now.
eliminate stress, reduce anxiety, and decrease depression. Dr. Fujian Zane's Awareness Integration Theory has helped thousands like you get incredible life-changing results. The Fujian app gives you her evidence-based treatment in the palm of your hand. Download today.
I am so excited to have you with us, Dr. Donald Meckenbaum. It is such an honor. I always get excited to speak with you, to see you, to hear your lectures. And I think this is the second or third time that I've had the honor of having you at the podcast. So welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for allowing me to speak to your audience. The topic today is a timely one. It has to do with the whole issue of anger and how anger is related to aggression. Let me make some introductory comments about how I intend to proceed, and then you could probe me along the way. Anger, like anxiety, depression, is an emotion, and there's nothing wrong with emotions. Emotions are really valuable messages to oneself and to others. And in some instances, anger is really very adaptive. We would not have social change. We would not have the Me Too movement. We would not have gay rights. We would not have many other forms of LGBTQ kinds of things if people did not become angry. And they usually become angry when they see a discrepancy between the way a thing is and the way they would like it to be. And they also experience anger in response to what they perceive as injustices, inequities in the system. So it's not per se that anger is good or bad. It's what one does with the anger that's going to be critical, and whether, in fact, anger escalates to the point of aggression. So in this dialogue that I'm having with you, I want to talk about the mindset that contributes to anger. I want to talk a little bit about the stability of aggressive behavior. And moreover, I want to talk about some of the main mechanisms, management procedures that people use. And then I'm presently working on a book on the prediction of violence, especially intimate partner violence, that I'll comment on as well. For those in your audience who want more of this, then I encourage them to visit a Melissa Institute that I run, a center. And they can go to this by going to www.melissainstitute.org. It's a violence prevention center that I have been running for 28 years since I retired. That's located in Miami, Florida. I also have a book that your audience can get for free, called roadmaptoresilience.wordpress.com. In fact, that book has been downloaded by 50,000 visitors in 138 countries. I've also completed recently two legacy courses that are relevant to this topic. So having made these introductory comments, we can move on to the stability of aggressive behavior and the manifestation of it in terms of people's mindsets.
I love what you said. I, you know, I opened two shelters and two transitional housing for the survivors of the domestic violence, and one in Northern California and one in Southern California. And I've been in the field of domestic violence for about 17, 18 years of actually working those two programs and creating them. And then obviously in my clients. One of the things that I loved about what you said is anger can be utilized, the behaviors of anger or expression of anger can be very constructive which is a lot of times what we used when someone was so helpless because they were abused for so long. And we needed to actually utilize the anger, the fire in them, to take them to a place that they could take care of themselves and take a stand for themselves, or that the anger can be destructive. So there's definitely a distinction, as you said, about not the feeling itself, but the expression of it and how it's utilized, whether it's utilized for taking a stand for yourself and making something better and construct a whole different concept for yourself, or destruction. Please.
So permit me to talk a little bit about the mindset of individuals whose anger escalates to the point of provocations of aggressive behaviors. People often become angry towards others. And what's interesting is that when people like Avril and others actually study individuals who are high versus low anger, high versus low aggressive behavior, the number of provocations they have, threats to themselves and others, is really comparable. So one of the things that's interesting is what distinguishes those for whom aggressive behavior develops. For aggressive behavior is, in fact, as stable over one's lifespan as is one's IQ, which is really kind of impressive. So they're able to choose, identify children in public schools who are, in fact, aggressive towards others. These children tend to see many threats, many provocations. They have what is called a hostility bias. They tend to view ambiguous cues as personal threats. This leads to the development and establishment of them thinking that these provocations or threats are done on purpose. That to get to anger, from anger to aggressive behavior, people often see that the intent of significant others by what they do or fail to do, what they say or fail to say, are really perceived as personal threats. This leads to a kind of planned script of behaviors. So the dominant response in response to these provocations and the like are, in fact, aggressive behaviors. Given your work on the work with intimate partner violence, let me ask you the following, okay? What do the following women have in common?
Many of them had come...
And I'm going to give you a list of women and ask your audience members to play along with us, to think about what's common among these women. Tina Turner, Loretta Lynn, Whitney Houston, Rihanna, Mariah Carey, Doris Day, Pam Anderson. You have any notions what's common among that group of women?
Well, many of them have been raised in families that they were also abused.
Right. And these are all very talented women.
Yeah.
Very beautiful women. And they all ended up with partners, intimate partners, who were abusive towards them. Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the interesting questions is, if we're in the business of predicting violence, okay, then we could ask the question, what is it that this group missed? So in fact, if your audience goes to the Melissa Institute website that I mentioned, they will find a podcast from me on a 5-game plan for individual women in particular to predict the potential violence of a prospective partner. Okay. So I'll take you through what we, based on this research by myself and a colleague named David Wexler, have I enumerated as predictive equations. I should note right from the outset that in 50% of the cases, women may initiate this aggressive behavior. So it's really a two-way street or bidirectional. And I should also note that the likelihood of aggressive behavior in partners is comparable in gay and lesbian couples as it is in heterosexual. So it has to do with more power and control than it does with regard to the gender of the partners. Okay. So one of the things we know about men who eventually manifest aggressive behavior is that they have a vulnerability factor. That is, if you look at their developmental history, they have often engaged in aggressive behavior. In fact, studies of dating high school students indicate that up to 40% of those couples in high school actually engage in aggressive behavior with each other. So there may be factors that lead people predisposed to be more aggressive. These men, I'll just walk you through the strategies, then you can probe therein. These men tend to have what are called love bombing activities. That is, at the outset, they are womanizers, they're very smooth, they're very demanding. They meet the needs often of vulnerable women. This kind of aggressive behavior moves into some kind of power and control and emotional coercion rather quickly. So the first element of what we highlight is the need for the therapist, the partner, the female in this case, to be trust their gut and to be a good observer. The female can also Google, Wikipedia, look at social media of their prospective partner. The third kind of thing is that they most likely should seek the feedback of significant others, like their family or friends. These guys are more likely to try to isolate individual women. And then finally, the female can perform a personal experiment. By that, I mean that they could disagree intentionally with the prospective partner and to see how they respond to that disagreement. So in the forthcoming book on intimate partner violence, we have focused in on how to help women make decisions that are both smart and safe so that they don't become another statistic. The anger escalating to the point of aggression is that the male in this particular case may have a disposition to think that the female should be available and be able to meet their needs even when they're not even expressing them. They're highly demanding and coercive. I don't know if that fits with your experience
very
in
much
terms of working with this kind of population.
Definitely, and I definitely see it more in obviously patriarchal systems, since you know I work with the multi cultural group. It was interesting because I'm taking this course at Harvard with evolutionary psychology, and the research from evolutionary psychology says that the aggression is also part of the mating strategy that shows up in a lot of animals, including human being, where especially the female sees it as the level of, oh, this male can protect me. So if they see some sort of angry outburst from them through with others, they figure, okay, this person can protect me. And this including what you just shared about love bombing at the beginning and all of this dynamic, it fools someone that this is going to be the mate for me. And they, you know, they get attracted to this type of a power, thinking they're going to be protected and not realizing that this is going to turn on them and attempt to control them in so many other layers. And I agree with you with the provocation of sometimes the partner, one partner also provoking, testing the ground on many of these issues. And then when the angry outburst comes in, sometimes it's a challenge for them. And sometimes it's almost what I've sensed also is I can handle, they figure they can handle this matter. Like I remember, right, Dr. Mechenbaum, I had one client who said, I knew my husband was going to come home, drink, beat me for an hour, and then go to sleep. So because I knew that, I facilitated it. So the minute he showed up, the way of survival was make sure he can drink a lot. I would go to this particular corner and I would facilitate so that he could be done with the beating because I knew he would go to sleep and then I could have the rest of the night with my children. And you could see sometimes the learned behavior of how to provoke and how to handle and then come out to the next step because somehow they assume they can control this matter, which gets them, you know, more abused or facilitates this abuse more. Right. Have you experienced that too?
Yeah. There, let me comment on two things that you mentioned. First is there's a very high likelihood of intimate partner violence and the presence of alcohol or some other kind of drugs. So in about up to 80% of the cases, either one or both partners are using some form of alcohol, which sort of shortens the fuse and results in people not having consequential thinking of what are the consequences of engaging in that kind of behavior. The second thing that you mentioned that I think is really quite relevant is that the women who are victims of these are rather strategic. You know, they have their own survival plans of being between, for instance, the perpetrator and their children or getting themselves safe and the like. In fact, women are most likely to be victimized when they're in the midst of trying to leave their spouse or partner. And I think, you know, this all came about for me in some sense in that I had a granddaughter who was living with me for the summer. And she would watch this TV program where the bachelorette would ask people questions. And I would, because we were confined in a limited area in Cape Cod in this house for the summer, and she watched this program regularly. When the program was over, I would then comment to her, since she's dating at that age, that these bachelorettes are asking the wrong questions. And therefore, you know, they're sort of being snowed under, if I could use that expression, by these prospective mates. And all those factors that she should probe. Here's an example of a question that's surprisingly instructive. If you are dating someone and you want to know something about the vitamin potential, and they happen to have a tattoo that you could see, it's really interesting for the female to say to the male, excuse me, is that a tattoo? I walk by these stores all the time, and I'm kind of curious if you could tell me the story. How did you choose that particular tattoo? Men often love to talk about their tattoos, and therefore, the story that they share with you about their particular tattoos may indicate some vulnerability factors. You know, they were gang members or they were part of a group who admires some kinds of violent behaviors in others. So therefore, I don't want to ruin people's relationships, you know, but I do want women to be smart and safe. I don't want them to become statistics like all those other women I enunciated. Does that make sense to you as well?
Very much. I think that I think there's a part of women who love the vulnerability and whether they see what the vulnerability is. But I think what factor that you're sharing, which is so important, which is distinguishing between the vulnerabilities and how it's going to manifest itself. Because women gravitate, right? Like we know about the research that they gravitate toward a man who is holding an infant, for example. So there's this softness that they sometimes they get excited about the person's feistiness and get more sexually attracted, but they get also feel safe with those vulnerabilities. But I think what you're sharing is also distinguish when you hear about the vulnerabilities of which one of these vulnerabilities could turn into the violent anger, violent expression.
Right. And usually this kind of violence behavior does not occur on the part of the partner until there's been some kind of sexual intimacy, unless someone has moved into the home of the female, whether there's some kind of financial kind of interdependence that emerges. And sometimes it does not even occur until after the wedding. So therefore, there's a real need to, be vigilant, to trust their gut, to search for significant others, what their opinions are, to do Google searches, and to even perform personal experiments in order to pretest the vulnerability that they may have. These are all relevant kinds of activities. There is a sense that some women engage in what is called white lies. You know, there's, the songs of marry the man and change his way tomorrow, right? So that women often feel that if they really are attracted, that they'll be able to overcome this. And, there's songs, there's a play, I love you, I love you now, change, kind of thing. And it's very hard to change this kind of behavior, especially if it's long lasting.
I don't know if you've seen the latest movie called Poor Things. Oscar also. It really shows the different types of vulnerabilities that men have toward, the rituals of mating that shows up. And in this movie, it shows all the different types of men and how, as you shared, how they come in at the beginning, and then when they create the attachment and then have some sort of then territorial concept with the control, and then how they act, when that type of control or territory is shaken up, and where, how the anger and the
I'll have to track that movie down, on Netflix or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. These are pretty good descriptions of the kinds of challenges women have. You know, one of the things that's interesting is that when we buy a car, when we're investing in a house, on an appliance, we go to Consumers Reports or we have a home inspector. We turn, buying a car is an expensive proposition. So sometimes we go and look up the characteristics. We feel that you should have a comparable outlet, a checklist of items to look for when you're choosing a mate. And that's sort of what we're working on right now. So we have those factors that are current, that you could see, like the love bombing, the emotional control. And then there are those factors that are developmental, the preoccupation with violence all the way through. In about 25% of the cases of these perpetrators, the research indicates that they've had a long history of co-occurrent violence with other kinds of psychiatric disorders. They may be depressed, they may have had hyperactivity, they may have had oppositional behaviors. So knowing something about their prior diagnosis, whether in fact there were some kinds of treatments, should give warnings. I wouldn't say that one's history is one's destiny, but it should give you pause. You know, think about emotions like anger as traffic lights, okay? So there are those emotions of pleasantness, love, joy, humor, and so forth, what are sort of green lights, go ahead with the relationship. Then there are red light kinds of emotions that say, you know, slow down, pause, don't get hooked up right away, find out other data. And then there's the yellow lights in between, which is a mixture of these two. And then one should not be rushed into romantic relationships until one ascertains from one's emotions whether there's a green light, yellow light, or red light. And that's the way in which we perceive this.
Dr. Mehrabaan, do you experience that this past, let's say, 10 years, due to the, let's say, social media and the political landscape, there's more of an allowance also to behave in an angry mode, and that has become more common publicly? Like if there was, at least if there was a politically correct way, or there was a professional way, or there was somehow that you wanted to be an appropriate citizen, that although you were angry, but you would watch in how you would, you know, assert your anger. Have you noticed the concept of anger not only risen? I think anger is anger, has always been there.
Yeah.
But the expression and the allowance of anger has been risen in a way that is more allowable and public, and as if it's promoted, as if like that's the way it should be. What are your thoughts about that?
I think you've put your finger on something really important. You know, I think whether it's the result of COVID, whether it's the political scenes, whether it's the allowance, there are a variety of emotions. I think people are more anxious, more depressed. And as you've described it, they've become more angry. And that there is a kind of social expectation in our society that aggressive behavior is common. I mean, you know, we're living in a time now when there's a war in the Middle East. You know, there's Ukraine, there's the political things of the challenge, and there's permission given by political figures. And if you go to the Melissa Institute, to give you one example of how we have addressed this, we've been concerned about police brutality. And in the aftermath of George Floyd's death in Minneapolis, where Chauvin, the policeman, had his knee on George Floyd's neck for 11 minutes, it turns out there were three other policemen standing by, and they did not do anything to intervene. So if your viewing audience visit the Melissa Institute, we have created there what we call a bystander intervention for policemen, so that when they see a colleague a policeman engaging in some aggressive behavior, they would be able to call it out. They would try and get them to stop now and plan a kind of a SNAP program. So if your colleagues go to the Melissa Institute website, they will be able to download for free the anger control program we have developed. They will also be able to download various kinds of mechanisms. So for example, let me give you one example. In my work with people who are angry, and we've developed a procedure called stress inoculation training, where we educate people about the nature of the anger. We actually give them some kind of skills training, relaxation, or of how to take a time out, how to view threats as problems to be solved rather than as personal challenges. So there are a whole list of possible coping techniques. And we try and make them aware of the interconnection between their thoughts, their feelings, and their behaviors. We want to make sure that the emotions that people experience, like anger and the like, do not hijack the frontal lobe. The frontal lobe being the part of the brain that deals with control in one form or another. So we educate people and we actually give them a trials of being provoked, which they can then try out these kinds of coping responses. So there are many examples. I've written books on anger control and the variety of techniques. But clearly, helping them understand, as you described, the relationship between anger and the aggressive behavior is a critical feature.
You also have a model, right? With the 12 o'clock, 6 o'clock.
I do have this model. And think of, if I may, think of the various things that people do or fail to do, what they say or fail to do. And for the moment, think of this as 12 o'clock, some kind of trigger, something that sets you off, some kind of challenging behavior. And that this 12 o'clock elicits some kind of emotions. So I asked the client, given what's just occurred, what are the specific feelings you have in that setting that preceded, that accompanied, that followed it? And anger may often be a secondary emotion. It may be in response to your feeling humiliated, or people not giving you respect, or even you're becoming depressed or anxious, you may become angry. And for the moment, think about these emotions, if I may, as a commodity. Ask yourself, what do you do with those emotions? What is the impact? What's the toll? What's the price you and others pay? So I'm trying to get people to slow the whole process down when they become angry. And then the other side of the emotions are the thinking processes, the 6 o'clock. Motions and cognitions are two sides of the same coin. So at 6 o'clock, you may have the attribution, the belief that this was done on purpose. You may have the belief that no one cares for you, that you're a burden on others. Whatever the nature of the thinking process is at 6 o'clock, it can exacerbate or make the emotionality at 3 o'clock even worse. 9 o'clock is, what do you do with those feelings? What do you do with those thoughts? They may be your particular behaviors, or maybe the behaviors of others that escalated. So one of the things that we try to do is we try to have clients who are angry do some form of self-monitoring so that they can keep track of the interconnection between how they appraise events, 12 o'clock, what are the accompanying feelings, what do they do with those feelings, what kind of thoughts precede, accompany, and follow it, And moreover, 9 o'clock, what do they do with it? This can become a vicious cycle. Therefore, once the client becomes aware of this process that they engage in, then we can explore with them what they could do at each one of these points in order to reduce anger. Can they, at 12 o'clock, appraise the event differently? Can they see it instead of being a personal threat, a violation of their code of honor? Okay? As someone else, can they perspective take? Can they try to understand the other person's behavior? And then we could teach them at 3 o'clock various ways to control their emotionality, okay? By changing the level of arousal, by taking slow deep breaths, by taking a time out from the particular situation of calming down. And then they could change the nature of the 6 o'clock, the nature of the automatic thoughts that precede the company and follow the event. So insofar as that seeing this is on purpose, this kind of behavior, they're going to escalate it. So in short, what we've done is we try to change the vicious cycle into what one might call a virtuous cycle. And therefore, this is not done overnight. This is done over a period of time, especially if people have a long history of aggressive behavior. Now, we should note that aggressive behavior often works in the short term, right? It helps you reach your particular goal. But in the long term, it has substantial consequences, both on your health. We know in terms of type A behavior that this leads to contributions of physiological responses, high blood pressure, heart attacks. And it also leads to poor interpersonal connections with significant others. So I work with individuals and see if this pattern of the 12, 3, 6, 9 o'clock makes sense to you, Fuji.
Absolutely. I think it is so important in how you've shared about a person having the ability to look at the what's happening and the result, and then go back and look at what was it that triggered them, what emotions, what thought process, what behaviors they did, and how they can shift those, as you said, calm down their body, shift their thought patterns, therefore their behavior is different. And it is so true that even when we're talking about the intimate partnership violence, that many times these types of angry outbursts and the way that they've showed their angry expression has worked for them. You know, maybe they bullied somebody and it worked for them. Maybe they got what they wanted in a short term and they worked for them. So as they were growing up, this type of angry expression was giving them some results. And therefore they kept continuing them. And I've seen a lot of times in relationships that this doesn't stop until either the person who's being abused take a stance and leaves, or that authorities and the law comes in and, you know, a bigger power comes in and stops it. So that therefore they see, oh, the result did no longer work for me, and they have to go back and kind of work through some of their emotions, watching not only they're going to get a legal consequence, but also the emotional consequence of losing their loved one and their children and all of it, which that right. bigger consequence sometimes finally gets them to a place of maybe I should reconsider and change and see what's happening within me. Dr. Mekam, we have about a couple more minutes. I want to see if there's anything we haven't shared that you really want our audience to know about the dynamic of violence and how they can work on themselves. And then obviously we'll definitely put the MiddleSlaInstitute.org into the description of this podcast so people can keep going back and look at all the wealth of information that you have offered on onto that website.
Yeah, I do encourage your audience to visit the Melissa Institute website and see some of the programs that we and others have developed. Everything on the Melissa Institute is free. I will comment finally that we have enumerated the variety of factors that, if in fact a male evidences history of violence, they do benefit from therapy. That their history is not their destiny, that with proper treatment, there is hope. And I want to make sure that the male takes responsibility for their aggressive behavior, that they've learned their warning signs, that they've developed coping techniques. Insofar as they're achieving those activities, you know, love relationships are wonderful if people could have it. And hopefully this presentation will facilitate that process.
Absolutely.
Thank you once again for having me.
Of course. Let me also show your two books that are so important for people to know. The Roadmap to Resilience, a guide for, let me see.
Or victims of violence and victims of trauma,
yes,
one form or another. That's the book that has been downloaded by 50,000 people in 138 countries. And it's available to your audience for free if they just go on and visit the appendices that will enumerate how to deal with a variety of affective responses, including anger.
Yes. And there's also, last year, you published this book, which I have, Treating Individuals with Addictive Disorder, the Strength-Based Workbook for Patients and Clinicians. And so for all of the therapists...
Since addictive disorders correlate so highly with aggressive behavior, this is also a valuable book in trying to enumerate how people can reduce their dependence on alcohol and other kinds of drugs.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for the time you allowed me. It is truly always a joy, and I always learn from you. So thank you.
Thank you.
And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.
Are you a psychotherapist looking to enhance your practice? The Awareness Integration Therapy developed by Dr. Fujian Zhang is a comprehensive guide to the principle and techniques of this powerful therapeutic approach. Join the growing community who have elevated their practice and expanded their skills by embracing Awareness Integration Therapy and witnessing its life-changing impact. Order your copy on Amazon now.
Break free from the forces holding you back. Get the life you deserve. Eliminate stress, reduce anxiety, decrease depression, and start living your full potential. Thousands have used Dr. Fujian Zhang's Awareness Integration Theory, an evidence-based behavioral health breakthrough with incredible life-changing results. Getting rid of past trauma, having fulfilling relationships, increasing earnings, and living their best life. Now, the Fujian app is available to everyone. The app is Dr. Fujian Zhang's Awareness Integration Theory in the palm of your hand. Download the Fujian app today.